Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Catherine Taylor Eubank, number 20793. With me is Tim Flanagan, and we are representing the appellant in this case, a landowner, Mr. Calavity. The question before the court is pretty simple. It is, can a party that is a material breach of a contract and there enforce the contract against the wishes of the injured party? Or can the party in material breach select the remedies of the for the injured party? And the answer to that is no under basic contract law. Restatement sections are very clear on this, that the plaintiff has the election of remedies. That's Restatement Section 378. Case law in Colorado follows that rule. The Cooper case at 725 Pacific 2nd 78 says that the injured party has the option of affirming or terminating the contract after a breach. The Interbank case, 12 P 3rd 1224, says the same thing after a repudiation by the breaching party. And the Trump case at 719 P 2nd 380 says that, again, that the injured party has the option of rescission or termination. In this case...
Mr. Van, can I interrupt you? You said a lot in a very short time. I congratulate you on that. I had a couple of questions, and I'll try to unpack all of the things that you said. You started by saying, and your brief repeatedly says, that the defendant can enforce a contract that it breached. I'm having trouble understanding how they're enforcing anything. They basically conceded a claim you made. I mean, so how is that enforcing the contract? Don't they get to say, we admit we breached?
Sure, they can admit that they breached, but that doesn't allow them to select the remedy of, we will pay what we owed under the contract and you don't have any other option.
But they didn't. You did. You brought a claim for breach of contract for the $35,000 amount or whatever else. That's the remedy you had. I'm just trying to understand how they are enforcing anything or selecting the remedy. They're conceding one of the claims you brought.
Mr. Calavity argued from the very beginning, he filed a petition for inverse condemnation saying that the contract had no effect. The judge would not allow him to proceed in that way, so he then brought an amended complaint for breach of contract. But whenever a contract is breached, that doesn't necessarily mean that the only relief our expectation damages, i.e. the amount that would have been owed under the contract had it been timely paid. The injured party, even in a breach of contract case, has the option of trying to rescind the contract and saying, no, they breached, they don't get to choose the remedy, I'm terminating the contract, the trial court is forcing me to bring this as a breach of contract claim. But I originally brought it as an inverse condemnation because the contract has no effect.
Well, let me ask about that. You say you get to rescind if there's a breach. They cite the restatement that says if it's just about money, you don't get to rescind. The cases you cite all say rescission requires, and I'm going from memory, but it's basically a substantial breach, irreparable injury, and damages can't be calculated. I mean, you keep arguing just because there's a breach, you get to rescind. Well, what do you do about the restatement section they cite or the case law you cite? I don't think you get to rescind and push back. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong.
Certainly will you.
Okay.
Thank you. Please. No, if there's a material breach that substantially affects the party. In this case, Mr. Calavity entered into this agreement in good faith, giving up supposedly his right to seek a judicial determination of the true worth of the property interest he was transferring to the city. He gave up that right and then didn't get paid for 2 years.
But may I ask you a question just on that point? When you're saying he didn't get the opportunity to get a valuation, but wasn't there an agreed upon valuation in the contract?
They settled. It was a compromise. It was a compromise amount. He chose, in order to avoid litigation, he compromised on the amount, even though he believed the amount would be higher if he went through a condemnation proceeding.
So then what else was he able to establish for his irreparable injury that would be other than the agreed upon value of the interest?
Well, I would say the fact that he's in his 80s, now I believe in his 90s. He's had to wait for this money. He had to sue to try and get enforcement of it. He's had to incur attorney's fees. A breaching party does not get to choose the remedy. I mean, it's that simple. A choosing party does not get to say, I breached, oops, 2 years later, now I get to pay you just what you were owed with a little bit of interest. That's not correct. And I believe in our reply brief, we did cite authority to support the idea that even though it's a money issue, there can be a substantial breach that requires the opportunity for other relief. In this case, our landowner client gave up his interest to the city, promptly signed over the easements, and yet was never paid. He had to sue, and, you know, does it make a difference if it's a governmental entity that has the power of condemnation? The only way it makes a difference in my mind is that the governmental entity has the obligation to pay just compensation, and they can't avoid doing that by settling and then not paying the landowner. They tried to unilaterally change the terms of that agreement.
Ms. Eubank, may I ask, I want to just make sure I understand the facts, and forgive me if I'm lost here. If I remember right, there are kind of two different pieces. They first settled, it was maybe $60,000 or something. Then there was another agreement that dealt with his driveway piece. That was $35,000. They paid the first part, right?
Here's just from the very beginning, the condemnation or the threat of condemnation, because there was an intent to condemn, a notice of intent, for one piece of property. And that was the November agreement in which Mr. Calavity said, I don't agree on the amount. I reserve the right to seek a judicial determination of the value of this property that you're taking. Let's continue discussing this in good faith and see if we can come to an agreement. Between that time and then the April 2009 agreement, the city decided it needed a little bit more property. So the second agreement was not only in relation to the new property, it was also in relation to the property previously taken. It was supposed to be a settlement of the entire amount so that Mr. Calabi would receive his money and not have to go through a judicial process. Well, now he's been through the trial court and now he's in the Court of Appeals.
And thank you for reminding me. So they paid the kind of first piece. It's the second piece where they bought the additional property they haven't paid. And there was a dispute on that one about moving a driveway, and they ultimately did it themselves. Is that correct?
That's correct. And the dispute was whether or not building the driveway was a precondition for receiving payment. And there was nothing like that in the contract. Mr. Calavi needed the money in order to build the driveway. He didn't, you know, he didn't have it on himself. So the fact that they didn't pay him, basically they forced him into not being able to build the driveway. Then they did it themselves unilaterally. And so, yeah, that's the sequence of events.
Is there anything in the second agreement that said that your client would build the driveway using the money with the first settlement?
No, there's nothing in the second agreement that stipulates how the driveway would be built. There's nothing in the second agreement that assigns a specific amount of money to the driveway. There's nothing in the written agreement itself that dictates, you know, timing or the amount of money dedicated to the driveway.
So your client's position is that he needed the money before he could build the driveway?
Yeah, the second agreement was to pay a flat amount of money, $35,149. And that included that Mr. Calavity would then build the driveway. The city refused to pay that entire amount, arguing that the driveway had to be built first. But the contract itself doesn't say anything in there about Mr. Calavity has to build this first, or that we're going to reserve part of the money until the driveway is built. There's nothing like that in the agreement.
Ms. Eubanks, and then correct me if I'm wrong, did the city ever offer to pay for the driveway?
They offered what they did was they withheld money and said, we're going to withhold this money until you build the driveway unless you agree to accept approximately $15,000 less than what we agreed to before. This is after the agreement's been entered into. So the only way they didn't offer anything. They withheld the money, and when Mr. Calavity hadn't built the driveway, they built it themselves. And so the first time they offered to pay the entire amount that was due under the agreement was when they conceded their breach and persuaded the trial court to enter judgment just for the expectation damages rather than allowing Mr. Calavity to say, no, you breached the contract, I get to say it's rescinded, and we get to proceed so that I can have the full amount of the property determined in a judicial proceeding. Thank you.
My name is Jeffrey Betts. I'm an assistant city attorney with the City of Westminster. I represent the City of Westminster along with Hilliard Graham, who's also seated at the table this morning. My registration number is 24956. I would like to first point out that Mr. Calavity's position all along in this case has been that there's been a material breach. There's never been a finding of a material breach in this case by a judicial determination. They continue to say that, but there's never been that finding. Whether this is really a simple breach of contract case in which involving the acquisition of several easements from Mr. Calavity, which resulted in a settlement agreement, a signed settlement agreement by the parties. Mr. Calavity claimed that the city breached that agreement, and what he's entitled to under the law is to receive the expectation of his interest or the benefit of his bargain under that agreement. And that's what he received from the court, and actually received more than that. This is a contract that was substantially performed by the parties. The city initially paid in November of 2008 $62,200, which represented 85% of the land that they ultimately were going to acquire. And that amount was based on an independent appraisal that the city had completed. They paid that money to Mr. Calavity in November of 2008, some 5 months before they ultimately entered into a settlement agreement. So they paid him a substantial part of the money. They negotiated with Mr. Calavity for 5 months on other issues involving just compensation or the payment of that of the value. They entered into a settlement agreement. Mr. Calavity signed the easements. The city then tried to pay Mr. Calavity everything he was entitled to under that settlement agreement. And the city built him a driveway in the amount of $20,000 that he never paid for.
City didn't pay him right away for the second agreement.
That's correct, Your Honor, and that's because the party's understanding was that the construction of the driveway by Mr. Calavity was a precondition of payment of that amount.
Wasn't in agreement, apparently.
I have to admit, it was not barely clearly stated, but there was a lot of negotiations, 5 months worth of negotiations that led up to that agreement, and the parties discussed that. Mr. Calavity had gone out and gotten a contractor and gotten bids. After the agreement was signed, he went through the process of getting that driveway permitted. The parties acted consistent with the fact that the construction of the driveway was a precondition. And I would like to address one of the issues that you raised, and that was whether there was any reference in the agreement with respect to the use of the money for construction of that driveway. I could be wrong, but I believe the record will reflect that the agreement does indicate that Mr. Calavity may have to use the $62,000 to go ahead and start construction of the driveway prior to the city's building their project so that he would have continued access for his home. And that was a big concern on the part of the city, was that project was going to eliminate his access. So we wanted to make sure if he was going to do it, he did it in a timely fashion. So there are three issues that I'd like to discuss with the court. First is the trial court's granting of the city's Rule 56H motion, then the dismissal of the petition and condemnation, and finally, the issue of attorney fees. The amended complaint filed by Mr. Calavity has two claims. One is a breach of contract claim, and the second, in the alternative, he specifically asked the court to declare that there was a material breach, that there was no meeting of the minds, therefore the contract was unenforceable, and that termination or rescission of the contract was appropriate. The amended complaint specifically alleges that the agreement to pay additional compensation, there was an agreement to pay additional compensation in the amount of $35,149, and that the city breached that agreement by making the construction of the driveway a precondition of that payment. Mr. Clavity then files a motion for summary judgment, putting that issue before the court. And the court specifically found that there was an issue of material fact with respect to whether or not construction of the driveway was a precondition of payment. Now, the city then, in light of that decision, decided to file its 56H motion for a couple reasons. Number one was to go ahead and narrow the issues for trial, so that the parties knew exactly what the issues were. And number two, in an effort to go ahead and stem the cost of litigation, we had two cities involved in litigating a $19,000 dispute. The city made a business decision at that point in litigation to concede Mr. Calavity's interpretation of the contract, and that was the construction of the driveway was not a precondition. We conceded that point. And then we asked the court to find two things. Number one, that the contract was enforceable based on the fact that they had pled that there was an agreement. And number two, that the amount of damage could be determined by the terms of the contract. In this case, it clearly spelled out it was $35,149. Since the city conceded the point, it eliminated any ambiguity whatsoever with respect to the terms of that contract.
The problem is this concession doesn't occur until long after the second agreement was entered into.
That's correct, Your Honor. And again, it wasn't because the city was trying to litigate this issue in bad faith. It firmly believed that the record and the evidence supported the fact that Mr. Calavity was responsible for building that driveway. It defended its position all along throughout that litigation, but at some point in time, it became apparent that Mr. Calavity was going to continue and pursue this litigation, and it just didn't make business sense to continue along that path.
Why doesn't it make sense if you admit a breach after you file your summary judgment motion that this breach is effective actually at some point after you entered into the second agreement and before he had to file another suit? He had to file his complaint for a breach of contract.
That's correct, Your Honor, because, I mean, the parties were in a dispute at that time.
Right, but why isn't that breach effective long before that?
I can't tell you whether or not it is or isn't. I think the city's position would be that it is not effective, but even if it were effective, his remedy is still the same, and that is because there was substantial performance, there was no determination that there was a material breach, that the most he would be entitled to is the expectation of his interest, which was clearly spelled out in terms of the agreement, $35,149, which the city actually deposited with the court along with interest from the earliest possible date of that breach going back to April of 2008.
Mr. Betsam, could you clarify then, when did the city offer to pay the $35,000 minus the expense of building the driveway?
There's a negotiation log in the record. It's probably 12 pages long, and there may be some reference in there. I did find some specific reference in the record in February of 2010. And the city said, okay, if you no longer intend to build your driveway, if you would like to consider a different agreement, we can amend the agreement. And that was in February of 2010. Now, what happened was, in April of 2009 is when the settlement agreement was entered into with the idea that he would construct the driveway. And the city, I don't believe, built its project until sometime that summer. So they were waiting for Mr. Calavity to go ahead and get the proper permitting and start the construction. So that led for some time. I think the city and the record indicates that, you know, they were waiting for him to construct it, so they were giving him some time before they would pay him. At some point in time, I think in the fall of 2009, it became apparent he wasn't moving along, and so the city decided to go ahead and construct the driveway on its own as originally planned, and that's the reference to the $20,000 driveway that they installed. And then we said, okay, if he's not going to go ahead and build the driveway, then maybe we can work a different deal, which is the reference that I made in February of 2010. So that may be the earliest in the record that that offer was made.
Mr. Betts, I've got a couple of questions just following up on Judge Marcus's question. If I remember right, when you finally conceded, you conceded for purposes of this motion only.
That's correct.
What exactly does that mean? I mean, how can you concede a fact for purposes of one motion? I mean, they essentially argue, this kind of goes to, really, I'm getting ahead of you, I think, on your attorney's, the attorney's fees issue. I mean, I think their principal argument is, this was gamesmanship. Why do you make them go through a summary judgment motion? I mean, you win, I guess, you get a fact question, and then you concede the issue and file another motion. You could have conceded long before you did. And then when you conceded for one purpose only. And so really two questions. One, what does that mean when you say I concede for this motion only as opposed to I concede this fact, period? And two, why aren't they entitled to attorney's fees at least for the delay, the period in which you could have avoided a whole lot of litigation by conceding the fact earlier and not make them litigate their summary judgment motion and then finally conceding it later? So two questions.
Sure. And let me answer that. The first question as to whether or not what it means by that, at least it was the intent of the city that in the event that the court did not grant the city's 56H motion, that it would leave itself the opportunity to argue that fact at trial. I don't know if that's a correct assumption, Your Honor, but that was the goal.
That's helpful. Thank you.
And with respect to the attorney fee issue, to the extent that you're referencing frivolous litigation, you know, the city.
Well, if Jim Snyder, so I'm clear, it not only is it frivolous, but unreasonably delaying or whatever the language is in the statute.
Sure.
Prolonging litigation.
I understand. The record indicates that the city tried to pay and made an offer to Mr. Calavity's attorney before litigation was initiated. We sent him a letter and said, we'll pay the entire amount. We'll pay the $35,000. It made a specific tender. They ignored that and filed their petition and condemnation.
That offer made?
That I don't know the date, Your Honor, but it was prior to the time that they initiated the initial petition and condemnation. So we made an offer to go ahead and try to settle the entire case. We recognized that it was not worth taxpayer dollars to litigate a $19,000 issue, so we made that offer.
Was it before or after they filed their summary judgment motion?
Well, it was well before the motion for summary judgment. It was before any litigation was initiated.
But your offer was only for $19,000. It wasn't for $35,000.
Actually, it was for the total amount, Your Honor, $35,149. Okay. That's correct.
So, Mr. Betsam, I'm a little bit confused. I thought earlier there was an offer made after Mr. Calavity's motion for summary judgment. So are we talking about two different things?
I'm not sure I said there was an offer made after the motion for summary judgment. We filed our 56H motion after the motion for summary judgment. In addition to that, we deposited the full amount of the $35,000 with the court. We made a motion with the court asking to deposit that amount, plus prejudgment interest from the date of the original agreement, which was back in April of 2009. I do want to touch a little bit more on that attorney fee issue because it's a significant issue. And, you know, the city prevailed in every aspect, every significant legal aspect of this case. You know, they filed a petition of condemnation. The city moved to go ahead and dismiss that. And while the court originally granted or denied the motion to dismiss, it ultimately agreed with the city and dismissed that petition of condemnation. We then, you know, responded to an answer. They filed a motion for summary judgment. The city opposed that motion for summary judgment. That motion was denied. We filed a motion to go ahead and submit the deposit to the court. They opposed that. The court granted our motion. We filed our 56H motion. The court granted that. They filed a 59. We opposed that. We prevailed. So we prevailed throughout this entire litigation. We did everything we could to try to stop this litigation and continue the waste. And so I don't know what else the city could have done other than the steps that it took to try to end this litigation prior to the time they even filed a petition and condemnation. Now, with my short time remaining, I'd just like, unless there's any other questions, with respect to the petition and condemnation, we believe that there's a timeliness issue as well. The court dismissed the petition and condemnation on April 26, 2011. And the notice of appeal was not filed until November 10th, 2011.
How was that dismissal filed? The court dismissed effectively without prejudice and let them amend their complaint.
You know, that's interesting, Your Honor. We raised that with the trial court. Once the petition was dismissed, there was nothing else to amend. There was no pleading.
Didn't the court dismiss with instructions to them to go ahead and file the complaint?
The court did that, and we raised that issue with the court because, frankly, we didn't understand how the court could do that. The petition... A petition of condemnation is a special statutory procedure that follows very specific directions under that statute. It's different. It's a petition versus a complaint. You know, there's a petitioner versus a plaintiff. There's damages that are awarded in a complaint for a breach of contract. There's just compensation awarded in condemnation cases. It's our position that once the court dismissed that petition, there was nothing to amend. Regardless, I understand what the judge said, but we don't believe that was proper, and we tried to raise that with the court. We suggested that the court allow time for Mr. Calabria to just file his complaint. You know, the petition was dismissed, go ahead and now file a new action for breach of contract. But the court didn't state it that way, but it is still our position that, you know, the timeliness of the appeal is not, it wasn't a timely appeal. I have 23 seconds. I think I'll stop at that.
All right, thank
you. Thank you.
Ms. Eubanks, you have about 4 minutes and 15 seconds.
Thank you. Well, I'm going to address first the factual issue, whether there was an offer made prior to litigation. And I have to admit that in preparing for this argument, I did not see that, but I can't say whether or not that is in fact the case. We were brought in for the appeal, and we were not Mr. Calavity's trial lawyers. So I can't swear either way on that one. My understanding and recollection was that Mr. Calavity was forced into litigation, which brings me back to the reason that the breach of contract justifies a rescission and allowing him to seek other remedies. The purpose of the settlement agreement, from Mr. Calavity's viewpoint, was to avoid litigation. He could have, you know, attempted to seek a greater amount of money for his property interests, but he chose to settle to avoid litigation. And in this case, he wasn't able to do that because he didn't get paid the amount he was supposed to be paid. So he had to be he had to go to court to try and recover that. So when you have a breach that defeats the purpose of the contract, that's a material breach. That's a material breach that allows the injured party to seek something other than the mere expectation interest from the contract.
Ms. Eubank, I recognize you strongly disagree with their position that you know, one could read the contract to mean that this was a condition that he build a driveway. But I mean, isn't it at least arguable? Wasn't this a legitimate contract dispute of the type we see every day, where one party says the contract means this and the other party says it means that? My concern is, if we say rescission is appropriate in this case, I guess I'm not sure what the limit is. It would be, you could argue rescission in any case where there's a breach.
Well, let me respond to that in two ways. First of all, a breach of contract does not have to be purposeful, intentional breach, in order to be a breach that allows the injured party some sort of remedy. In this case, the trial court granted essentially summary judgment. If there was a fact issue, then the court ruling is incorrect and should be reversed as well. If there's a fact issue for determining what is the scope of the breach and whether it allows for another remedy, or whether or not the building of the driveway was a precondition. Those are, if those are fact issues, now that last point was conceded by the city, which you asked, how can you limit that to just one motion? We would say you can't. But if it was indeed a fact issue, then the court erred in granting summary judgment in the first place. So it should be reversed. It should be reversed with at least the right to go to trial on those contract fact issues. And I would disagree also with the point about the inverse condemnation. Mr. Calavity did what the trial court told him to do. There was no final judgment as far as he knew because he was still in court with the same case number with a complaint now in contract, although he wanted to be in inverse condemnation the whole time. If there are no other questions, thanks very much.
Okay. Well, thank you, counsel, for your very helpful arguments. The case will stand submitted and an opinion will issue in due course.